York City. It's the Gary Knoll Show.
This will be an everlasting love. This will be the one I've waited for. This will be the first time anyone has loved me.
And now, your host, so Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a program about empowering people how to live a longer and healthier life. Everything stated comes from peer-reviewed literature from respected institutions, and we cite everything on our website, prn.fm, if you'd like more detailed reading. Today, we're going to look at how chemical compounds found in essential oils improves wound healing. Indiana University study, and that's just the beginning of what we'll be sharing. That's published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE. Also today, I'll be doing a commentary about the corruption of our political process, where we exclude third parties from having any power or say-so. We don't allow the Ralph Naders, Rocky Andersons, Jill Steins, and others to be able to speak on issues that we're all concerned about. These are true populists. Instead, we hear from the corporatist, whether it's Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. It doesn't matter. Democrat or Republican, they've both been captured by multiple sources, and they do their bidding. And we're supposed to act as if we're too distracted to care or too illiterate to understand. There's a new movie out. It's by Clint Eastwood. I saw it last night. I rarely go to the movies when I'm doing a support group, especially an anti-aging clinical study. Some people are leaving tomorrow. They did their blood work up today. They will have concluded their 60 days. Now they'll go home and do another 30. But I thought it would be a nice respite just to get off campus and see this. After watching it, it's based upon a true story of a man named Joel, who was actually a hero and found a satchel full of bombs at the Atlanta Olympics and warned people of it and saved hundreds of lives. And yet the FBI attacked him and said he was the number one suspect and then leaked that information to a reporter who published a front page story in the Atlantic Constitution about this. They did everything humanly possible to destroy his life. In the end, he was vindicated. In the end, they had to acknowledge he was innocent. And about 5 or 6 years later, the real bomber was caught and admitted it. But nobody apologized, no one in the media that pillared him. And so I read a review of the film on Variety. Variety is the oldest continuous publication highlighting everything in the entertainment business, films, television, music, etc. And they hated the film with a passion. And yet their criticism was about protecting the establishment, protecting the FBI, and protecting journalism and journalists. Well, what about the truth? What about the real story? That seems to have been irrelevant to the reviewer at Variety, which has enormous impact upon the film industry. So today, a commentary. Can we trust the FBI? Can we trust the CIA? Can we trust the deep state? Can we trust the papers like the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN and MSNBC and all their acolytes who are well-educated, very intelligent, very capable of journalists? But it seems, though, they do more with those talents protecting those who have conspired against us than revealing the dark and dirty secrets of those that have attacked us. My commentary on that today. Also today, we're going to take a look at something that has not been released in the United States. I think I'm the first person to release it. All this nonsense about, quid pro quo. Why don't you take a careful look at the Bidens? My information says they received $17.5 million. Who says that? The person who took the place of the inspector general, or what you would call their attorney general, their leading prosecutor in the Ukraine. But wasn't it Biden who said, in 6 hours, I'm going back to the United States, and if I don't have that man's being fired, you're not going to get $1 billion. And then they fired that man, the Ukrainian president fired him. I looked into his background. He was an honest, courageous, determining factor in getting rid of corruption in the Ukraine, and including Burisma. I'm talking about the man who took his place, someone that the United States looked favorably upon, someone who was happy to do the U.S.'s bidding. He has some interesting things to say. That'll be an interesting 3 minutes. Also, how did Joe Biden make his millions? We'll discuss that. And then on a more positive note, from Dr. Wim Momaw, M-O-O-M-A-W, Humanity's Mortality Moment. It's a long piece. I'll play as much as I can. So that's our program. No calls today. I want to get as much of this in as possible. From Indiana University, they're telling us from the research they've done that there are chemical compounds found in essential oils to improve the healing process, at least in mice, when it's topically applied to a skin wound. Now, think of all the people suffering from MRSA and other antibiotic-resistant infections that cause tens of thousands of lives just in the United States. So what are these special chemicals? Well, there's one in particular. It's called beta, B-E-T-A, carophyllene, C-A-R-O-P-H-Y-L-L-E-N-E. I spell these because we have a lot of physicians, nurses, and scientists listening to this program, and I want them to be able to do their own research and know where to start on it. Now, where do you find it? For the layperson, you get it in lavender oil, rosemary oil, Lang Lang oil, that's Y-L-A-N-G, as well as various herbs and spices like black pepper. And it showed increased cell growth and cell migration critical to wound healing. They also observed increased gene expression of hair follicle stem cells in the treated tissue. Ah, then could that help us with hair growth? That I haven't seen, but it's promising. But at least we know it makes a big difference of using this in the appropriate way, and generally use it in a diffused form, not straight oils. That can be too hard. Like you would never just drink wild oregano oil. Not that it's going to hurt you, but it's going to sting. And it's always best to use these in a diluted form. And so essential oils are natural concentrated oils extracted from plants. They're used by humans, dates back to ancient Egypt. But the scented oils have experienced a resurgence in popularity in the United States, and good for them. Good for all the herbalists in the United States. You're doing a good job, and especially the scientists who are providing the background efficacy and safety to be able to use these in the proper way. And just as an aside on that, just some free thought here. We like to think that we're the most hygienic society in the world. We're not. Most Americans don't even wash themselves properly and disinfect their anus or the reproductive system after they've defecated or urinated. They don't wash their hands properly. Go into any airport or even in a movie theater, and you'll see people just sometimes not washing at all, or other times just running some water over the hands. That does nothing. You really have to lather up and properly scrub the hands between the fingers and the palm of the hand under the nails. We don't do that. I've owned 3 very successful restaurants, and I had very strict standards, and I was watching all the time. Is everything triple washed? Are all the surfaces at night, disinfected? When people walk into a kitchen, do they wash their hands properly when they come out of a bathroom? Do they wash their hands? And unless you're on top of people, they won't do it. So imagine when you're not on top of it. Imagine living in a house where someone leaves the toilet open up and defecates. Thousands and tens of thousands of bacteria and viruses now go into every inch of that bathroom. So if you have a family using a bathroom or even a partner using it with you, everything that's in their body in the way of feces is going to come down and going to land on your toothbrush, your soap, your washcloths, all the handles, and that's how we cross-infect one another. Well, there have been societies, including the Roman society, I'll get into that on another day, that they had stages of hygiene depending upon your class and wealth. But going clear back to ancient Egypt, they had their big, what do you think the two biggest things that bothered the Egyptians were on a day-to-day basis? Huh? Lice and mosquitoes. Now, those who could afford it built little towers, and they had windows with a mesh in it. They had linen, and so the linen, a mesh, would prevent mosquitoes from getting in at a little higher elevation, let's say 20 feet or so. And other people would put these netting around them at night. That helped. But during the daytime, lice was everywhere, from the most noble, the pharaohs and their family, to the most common worker. So they shaved all their body hair. They had very intricate ways of shaving the scalp, the eyebrows, underarm, and the pubic hairs, and that minimized it. Then they would use clay and other oils mixed together to massage in to help prevent this, and some aromas from aromatherapy seemed to work better at preventing the lice from infesting them. So they made wigs, either horse hair wigs or human hair wigs, and they would wear those. They would have very intricate cosmetics made from, again, different soil pigments and oils. So they would paint their face. They understood how to deal with acne. They understood even manicures and pedicures. If you were very wealthy, if you had someone do it for you, there would be baths. And yes, the wealthier people would take baths. They would stand in a little bowl, and someone would lather them down and then pour water. Unfortunately, almost all water in Egypt was contaminated because it came from the Nile. And the Nile also was where all the average people did their laundry, and as well as throw their defecation into the Nile. But that's where the drinking water was, water for washing and irrigation, not the least of which was problematic because hippopotamuses and crocodiles also inhabited the Nile and took their fair share of people who didn't realize how fast a crocodile can get out of the water. And a hippo is even meaner than a crocodile and more powerful. But they did their best with what they knew. So they practice hygiene. They practice washing themselves. They knew the importance of keeping clean. They had oils that they would use on their finger to brush their teeth and gums with because they wanted to have sweet breath. They didn't like bad breath. They would do this after meals. They also had took something from many of the African cultures, little picky, little like a toothpick made from twigs they would put between their teeth and pull out any of the debris between the teeth, and that also helped them. They ate a pretty good diet, all things considered. It was a healthier diet than most had and allowed them to live a pretty long life. And they also knew how to protect their sun. They had like sunscreens clear back then to protect their skin, because they're not, mind you, even the darkest skinned person, because of the melanin, is not protected from skin cancer. That's a myth. So they did a lot of hygienic things back then that many people today don't even consider. But the essential oils is what they really mastered. They had dozens and dozens of these oils. They also had mint. They grew mint, and they liked the taste and smell of mint, so they would use mint in their body lotions. And they didn't like underarm odor, so they would make a paste and wipe it under the arm, which would exfoliate a lot of the, let's say, the bacteria, which is what really causes the smell, the type of bacteria you have with your perspiration and sebum. And then they would massage an oil on that. It generally contained some mint, so everyone tried to smell good. Breath was kept as clean as they could. They bathed regularly, except some bathed where it was safer than others. But the water was universally bad, so infections were very common and parasites were epidemic. A smart culture. And today, half of all Americans within the next 10 years, half the entire population will be obese. Not overweight, obese, latest study today. And other cultures pride themselves on staying fit. They knew that they would be healthier and live a longer life. From Oregon State University comes a study about watermelon supplements bringing health benefits to people who are obese. In this case, it was in laboratory mice. The Journal of Nutrition, peer-reviewed journal, says that eating watermelon, now you can eat it in the form of powders, but you can help avoid a lot of the things that are in an unhealthy diet when you do this. So this is a good study. Oregon State University College of Agricultural Sciences did this study. Professor of Food Sciences led it, and they found that watermelon seeds or even watermelon powder, terrific for you. So I consider watermelon one of the three most important fruits to eat, along with pomegranate and grapes. And so eat it fresh, organic, good. Juice it, better. Concentrate, better still, or the powder is best of all because you're getting the greatest amount. And it also was shown to help lower blood sugar and therefore lower your incidence of diabetes. And that's terrific. So watermelon, eat the seeds or grind them up and drink the juice. It's a great detoxifier, terrific for you. One more quality study done at the Gansu University of Chinese Medicine and published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Oncology. How about that? They found evidence for association of acupuncture and acupressure, both using the needles, then using the end of the finger into the needle point, with improved cancer pain. So this is a good study. In effect, it acted like an analgesic, and they actually did it as a placebo study. And then they looked at 17 randomized clinical trials, what is called a meta-analysis of 14 trials, and published in the English language. And they found there was benefit, so something to consider. Also, from Sun Yat-sen University in China comes a study about the greener the areas around schools, the lower likelihood of ADHD symptoms. Bottom line, attending schools in greener areas appears to be associated with a lower likelihood of having symptoms of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in this observational study of 2,566 children. And finally, from the University of Washington, published in the peer-reviewed journal of Public Policy and Aging Report, human life expectancy worldwide rose dramatically over the past century. In the United States, it's going backwards. But people's health spans, the period of life spent free of chronic age-related disease or disability, has not increased accordingly. So in effect, we're keeping people alive longer with different medical interventions, but not in a healthy way. And they took a look from the Gerontological Society of America to see what could be some of the causes. And they titled an article, "Is Aging Still a Disease? Perspectives from Geroscience." The journal highlights existing studies. And they're saying that the best articles they have found is that this is the time, with all we know, to extend the human lifespan. It can be increased. But they have to differentiate between increasing the lifespan when you're sick and increasing the lifespan to stay healthy. That they didn't mention. And that's why this study, where everyone was over getting their final blood work up today, and we'll know the results shortly, from what I understand, the final research methodology and statistical analysis is being completed today. So I should be able to see it next week. So the good news is people are paying attention. People are asking basic questions. Can we live a longer life? Yes. And then they ask, is targeting aging the future of medicine? Should be. But before medicine does that, you would have to ask, can it coexist? Can it be a complementary part of the existing pharmaceutical model? The answer is, it is problematic unless the major companies own patents in some form of anti-aging procedure, stem cells, where they can say, yes, take this, and then it'll get into the medical curriculum, then it'll be used in medical offices, then it'll be at medical conferences for continuing education graduate credits. But until that time, it is my feeling, a subjective thought, that if we have a major breakthrough, which I believe we will, that it will be seen as a threat to the enormous profits over $1 trillion a year that major pharmaceutical companies make, in which case they will do everything in their power to try to discredit it. Fortunately, knowing that that was possible, the people who designed the study guidelines, all orthodox mainstream MD, PhDs, built in there the factor of institutional bias, and they made it as strict could be. And so any challenge we have, we'll be able to meet the challenge. Plus, we filmed the entire thing, every person, everything they've done. So we have meticulous documentation, blood workups, journals, nurses, reviewing every single thing that was done and taking notes. So no holes in this study, and hopefully we'll have some positive announcements on it next week. But medicine's paying attention only to the degree they can benefit from it. One last thing from Japanese Institute of Sports Medicine. Have you been taking your curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N? If you have, after you work out, it eases post-workout muscle soreness. So that's good. It can help you if you're using non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. This is a natural plant phenol. It's an aromatic colorful compound found in plants, and it's the principal extract of curcumin longa, which is the turmeric plant. And turmeric is a member of the Zingiberaceae, the ginger family of flowering plants. And curcumin is responsible for imparting the bright yellow color to turmeric spice used in many popular Asian dishes. It's also a very powerful anti-inflammatory, reduces discomfort, especially after exercising. So something new, something you can use. And by the way, it was who said that we're going to have half the population obese in just 10 years? Harvard School of Public Health. Today. Yeah, today. They published the article in the New England Journal of Medicine, the current issue. So that means about 175 million people by then, projecting our 333 million up to 340 million, half obese. That means higher death rates in children, adults, seniors. That's what's facing us if we don't make change. We're not going to, unfortunately. Back in a moment with a special commentary. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. Please go to prn.fm, look at the articles. We have, according to our archivist, 746 articles that I've written that are on that line. That's not all the articles, but it's all we actually have archived. And the latest one is just was put up there on Monday about Gardasil vaccine. And we have a lot on Wikipedia, and including 70 articles, and we're working on 200 more. So if they thought that we had made our effort, no, we're just beginning our effort, as they will see. We're going to go now to the Ukraine files. Listen to the people, because the people you're going to hear are former or current prosecutors in Ukraine. And here's what the media and Congress in their hearings have not exposed.
A new report finds Joe Biden and other Obama-era officials ran a multi-million-dollar racketeering scheme in Ukraine for personal gain. One America's Christian Rose examines the claims.
A new report suggesting Joe Biden may have been paid up to $1 million in proceeds of high-profile corruption in Ukraine. In a Wednesday interview, the president's attorney cited a report by Ukrainian MP Andrei Derkach documenting money transfers from Ukrainian energy company Burisma to the firm Rosemont Seneca, which represented Biden's interests in that country. Derkach claims Biden was paid $900,000 to pressure the Ukrainian government not to investigate the business of Burisma.
Joe Biden was irritated by the six criminal cases involving Burisma, his fifth in 2 years. I would like to emphasize Biden's fifth visit to Kiev in December 2015 had one purpose, to get Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin fired because of his probes into Burisma.
Giuliani says Hunter Biden, who was a board member of Burisma between 2014 and 2019, had close ties to Burisma CEO Mykola Zlochevsky. Zlochevsky is known for bribing top officials of the pro-Russian Yanukovych administration of Ukraine to expand his business in the country. After the 2014 revolution, Zlochevsky found new protection for his corrupt dealings, the U.S. Embassy, and Vice President Biden. Derkach claims and affirms that Joe Biden repeatedly pressured the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine, or NABU, to protect Zlochevsky, who paid Hunter Biden for this protection. He says this racketeering scheme enriched the Bidens and potentially other Obama-era officials. For example, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky identified former U.S. Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch as, quote, a bad ambassador in the July phone call with President Trump.
Indeed, we're ready to investigate the Burisma case. I've told you about this before. It will be a joint investigative team, a joint team of American and Ukrainian general prosecutors.
Derkach also claims Hunter Biden received an additional $16.5 million in proceeds of corruption from Burisma. The MP says in 2014 the NABU opened several probes, including one into Zlochevsky's forced acquisitions of assets and the transfers of money to the Bidens. All these investigations then ground to a halt and were later closed, which Derkach claims happened upon request by the U.S. Embassy.
Recently, our prosecutor general, Raboshapka, said he's auditing all criminal cases into Burisma, alleged U.S. election meddling, and other cases of transnational corruption. I am transferring my findings to the prosecutor's office for review.
Derkach has promised more disclosures on Biden's activities under the previous Ukrainian administration, saying the documents are now leaking from the high levels of the Ukrainian government. Meanwhile, Giuliani says he will be releasing more of his own findings on Biden in the coming days.
Okay, so there you have it. Why isn't any of that information? Why haven't these two prosecutors, the one that was fired and the one that replaced him, been invited to the United States to speak before open sessions of Congress about the fact that the American ambassador came into his office, the new person's office, after the old one had been fired because of Joe Biden, and demanded that three people not be investigated. Those investigations stop. And he wrote the people's names down, and then he tore up the paper and said, no, I'm not going to do this. You know, I'm not going to stop an investigation because you want it. And that was the person that then said before Congress, oh, that none of that happened. Yes, it did happen. And there's evidence and multiple witnesses. Now it's just not one former prosecutor. It's two former prosecutors stating this. Yet you wouldn't know that from the American media, would you? So this story is not going to go away. We're going to finish off our program in a few moments here with a look at an area from Dr. William Mumau, Humanity's Mortality Moment. But first, I was just notified that Power Berry Blast, which has been out of stock for 5 months, is back. And we're not going to run out of stock on anything more because we have consolidated everything into a one office. So we have greater control systems, and we even have a computer system now that takes it out of the hands of people who can forget, and this one doesn't forget. So we've got everything. And now the Power Berry Blast, since we just got it back just today, and it'll go out today also, we're going to give you a really good discount. It's normally $120. It's $83.99 today. And if you didn't know why Powerberry Blast is so important, let me just share the ingredients with you. First and foremost, it has blueberries as the number one ingredient, then raspberries, beets, black currants, cranberries, goji berries, acai berries, bilberries, grapeseed extract, aronia berries, cherries, elderberries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, camus, pineapple, guava, bananas, quercetin, and stevia with a natural berry flavor. It's vegan, it's non-GMO, it's gluten-free, and it's phenomenal. So it's called Power Berry Blast. I haven't had any myself in about 5 months. Now we have it. So this is the one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, berry formula ever. I created this for the reason that all the scientific literature was showing the power of berries. So you're getting them all. You're getting all the superstars here. This is Power Berry Blast. It's back in stock. And so call this number, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And you're saving today, let's just see, a 93, 103, 113. You're saving a lot of money, almost $35, by calling today. And I'm giving you that deep discount because we've been out of it. So I just want to make sure that you get it back and put it in your formula with all, everything else every day. Power Berry Blast back in stock, just arrived today. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 to get your Power Berry Blast and see the difference in how you feel. Now, we're going to finish off our program today with having you, you can watch, by the way, you can go to youtube.com/PRNFM, that's youtube.com/PRNFM, and or you can listen to Dr. William Mumau on Humanity's Mortality Moment.
Can down the road. Here's a contact address if you'd like to get in touch with us. And November of this year, front page of our article that was just referred to, which has had an amazing response. Nitrous oxide from fertilizer, they emit methane from primarily animal husbandry. And we need to shift our food and diet away from animal and towards plant-based foods.
No more Big Macs?
Well, they are now have Impossible Burgers and all kinds of things made from plant foods that are selling really well, apparently, at least in the United States, which is where we are the king of Whoppers when it comes to hamburgers.
And we just have to consume less meat products to start with.
That's right. That's right. We have an economy that is geared to, it could not be better designed to emit carbon dioxide and other gases into the atmosphere than it is. I mean, it's just amazing how we have become so reliant on fossil fuels. And so we need to reduce the activities that that release those emissions and these heat-trapping gases and create a carbon-free economy.
It's the economy, our current mainstream growth economic system, that is causing our doom. It's incenting us to consume the planet more and more quickly. It's an insane system, but they can't get off it, because if they stop that exponential growth, the Ponzi scheme falls apart.
It is a bit of a Ponzi scheme, and it takes all kinds of interventions to keep it going from central banks and so forth. So it is not just a market system running itself like it was promised to be way back in the 18th century. And it needs a lot of work to keep it running. And then finally, there's the human population. We're adding 80 million people a year to the planet's human population. There are economists that will tell us that we have to keep having more population growth to keep the economy going. I find it absolutely bizarre that my role in society is to keep the economy going, and it's women's role in the society to keep having babies to keep the economy going. I find that just an extraordinarily bizarre notion of what is most important. Does the economy serve us, or do we serve the economy? And so one of the ways, things we have to do is to do this in a way that will keep society intact. And one of the things we can do is to provide education for women, girls all over the world, and provide women and girls with information about managing their own fertility. So why would 11,000 scientists agree to declare a climate emergency? Being a scientist, I can tell you, we're a pretty contentious lot. We argue a lot about the science. Did you measure that right? Did you do this? To get 11 scientists to agree is really remarkable. To get 11,000 scientists to agree is just extraordinary.
So I can use that old New York joke, you get 11 scientists together, you get 13 opinions?
That's right, at least 13 opinions. So we use the term emergency deliberately. We felt that terms like crisis and disaster are not very helpful. They simply leave you feeling depressed because there's nothing you can do about it. There's not even a possibility suggested in those terms. But emergency means something something dangerous is about to happen, and you can work to prevent it, or you're going to have to respond to a mess afterwards. Just like you can prevent an automobile accident, or you can deal with it after the crash. And we want to try to do it before rather than after. So we are, as scientists have improved their capacity and had more time to gather more information about what's happening in the world, we've come to recognize that abrupt and irreversible changes are coming at lower and lower increases in temperature. So these four bars here represent the estimates in four Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports beginning in 2001. Every 6 years, one of these reports comes out. And back in 2001, and I was a coordinating lead author of one of the chapters there about emissions from industry and transportation and everything, and we thought that maybe somewhere around 5 degrees Celsius, we would start seeing irreversible changes. That's how little we knew, because by then it wasn't obvious that Greenland was melting. It wasn't obvious that Antarctica was melting. We were just beginning to see the melting of the Arctic sea ice. And then 5 years later, it looked like it might be somewhere between, maybe a little below 5 degrees. And then 6 years later, it looked like it might be around 4 degrees. The report that came out just a year ago, it's between 1.5 and 2 degrees. How, you know, everybody says, what's the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees? 1.5 to 2 degrees difference is we get a lot more irreversible changes at 2 degrees.
I just have a question to interject here, yeah. And that is, I've heard a lot of people who are not really cognizant of the science poo-poo the issue of climate change by saying scientists keep changing their mind, they don't know what they're talking about, they're exaggerating. How do you address this type of charge when it has gone from, like, we need to keep it below at 5 degrees to, like, 1.5?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the thing is that a lot of people have the attitude, you know, my opinion is as good as yours. But the famous statement is, you can choose your opinions, but you can't choose your facts. Scientists don't make up facts, and therefore they don't claim things that they don't know about. And back in that earlier time, we just didn't know. You know, with the information we had, 5 degrees looked like what it was. And I'll have to say this, I cannot think of a single thing that has been studied in science about climate change that has come to the conclusion that it's not going to be as bad as we thought it was yesterday. It just keeps getting worse and worse as we learn more and more, because things are getting worse. That is, this is not just some creeping problem that will be future generations. It is accelerating every single day from what it was before. So let's just take a quick look here that there are changes in the world, and many of them are becoming irreversible. And this is just a map that was put together, and it just shows the different things. You know, the thawing of the permafrost. You know, if the permafrost thaws, this is basically like the carbon in the soils is like frozen meat in your freezer. What happens when the electricity goes off and that meat thaws, it rots. And that means bacteria are chewing on it. And it's the same thing is happening. It's not meat that's in permafrost. It's basically organic carbon in soils. But the same thing happens. In the liquid water, the bugs wake up and they're able to start devouring it and they start exhaling methane and carbon dioxide. The melting of ice in Antarctica, the melting of ice in Greenland, the rising of sea level, all of those things are on this map. So climate tipping points are too risky to bet against. We don't know where they are. We don't know what all of them are, but there are enough of them out there. Oh, by the way, I might just say, you could say if any one of these things is on this map, oh, it's just a coincidence. But the fact that all of them are happening and they're all traceable to a changed climate makes it pretty certain that this is really caused by climate change. And so the growing, this is a direct quote from this paper, the growing threat of abrupt and irreversible climate changes must compel political and economic action on emissions. There is no scientific action. There is no magic bullet. It is, we have to change and respond to this in our economy and in our political system, and that's supposedly what we're here in Madrid for. Question, are we running out of time? Well, boom. This is a remarkable graphic that was put together, and what it shows is the historic trend, that's the black line, and then the various colored wedges going from darker red to lighter pink are really the following situations. The first is the current policies. We're somewhere in that range, just doing what we're doing now, business as usual. But didn't we have Paris? We did have Paris. This is what the commitments will get us. It's a little bit better, but it's nowhere near as enough, nowhere near enough. But in Paris, we said, that's what countries did in their nationally determined contributions. But they said we should not get more than 2 degrees. We have to be somewhere in that wedge going down to stay within 2 degrees and to stay within, make all efforts to stay within 1.5 degrees, we have to go down in that really steeply dropping one.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to put a little more time pressure on you to finish up, but the 1.5 and the 2 degree goals, the guys and girls over there keep moving the goalposts. They should be 1750, and if you go from the 1750 baseline, then we're already at
1.5 degrees. Right.
But they moved it to 1850 because that's when the, et cetera, they had reasons.
That's right.
It's convenience.
That's right. Well, and that's when the thermometer record starts, and it's a little difficult to estimate 1750, but that's no reason to ignore it. It was cooler in 1750 than it was in 1850.
And then some countries came in and said, we're going to use a 2005 baseline.
That's right.
Because we can.
That's right. In a bleak report that just came out a little over a week ago by the UN, this remarkable statement in there, we need to catch up on the years in which we procrastinated, a top UN official said. Global greenhouse gas emissions must begin falling by 7.6% each year beginning in 2020, a rate currently nowhere in sight to meet the most ambitious aims of the Paris Climate Accord. In 2005, I wrote a paper doing an analysis. It was called the 2% Solution. If beginning in 2005, we had reduced our emissions by 2% a year, by 2050, we would, and assuming that we didn't destroy nature that's sucking up carbon, that we would be, we would have stabilized the climate and the temperature at sort of reasonable levels around 350 parts per million or something like that. So we've wasted that opportunity. And to add, so I guess, salt in the wound is the term that people use. The World Meteorological Organization just announced, no big surprise, that despite all the things that we say we're doing, carbon dioxide emissions reached a new high. And so did a lot of other gases, methane and other heat-trapping gases. So we need to catch up on the years in which we procrastinated. That's a message for the negotiators who are here in Madrid right now. That is a very untypical statement from a UN agency. That is a harsh statement in diplomatic terms. but it's very much on target.
Does that mean, does that statement indicate that not only do we need to meet net zero, but actually negative, we need to draw down right away?
Yes, thank you. Let me just say, here's the 1.5 degree report, and let me just put it in the context of this, the answer to your question. So this was came out just a little over a year ago, and here's what it says. To keep temperatures from rising above the 1.5 degrees, global net anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions must decline by about 45% from below 2010 levels by 2030, reaching net zero around 2050. All right, so now we're on the verge of 2020. That means we have just 11 years till we get, you know, we go through 2000 and then, or 2020 and then up to 2030, 45%. That's why we have to go down by 7.6% a year.
Oh, but it's only 2019. I got 20 years. I can do it.
Yes. The trouble is people think, oh, let's wait till 2030 and then let's go. Let's go on it. I when I talked to my students, I said, that's the equivalent of students sitting in lectures, not doing the assignments, and then staying up all the night before to do the final exam. That usually does not work out well. It doesn't work out for students. It doesn't work out for diplomats. And it doesn't work out for the planet. And so here's the point that people really need to understand. We must simultaneously reduce combustion emissions and all other sources of emissions of carbon dioxide and from methane and from all these other heat-trapping gases. And simultaneously, we must increase the removal of atmospheric carbon dioxide by nature-based solutions. It's not either or, it's both and. And this number, this business net emissions, what that means is the difference between what we put in and what nature takes out. A term is commonly used, you'll hear it, is, you'll see it on the signs around here, carbon neutral. Oh, that sounds so good. That's not a scientific term. Carbon neutral is not the same as zero carbon. Carbon neutral means someone else at some other time, at some other place, removes carbon so I can emit more.
Maybe, because this is an accounting system that they came up with in there to allow wealthy countries to pollute more while they supposedly plant more trees in Indonesia, which are probably harvested 5 or 10 years down the road.
That's right. I mean, it's not only Indonesia. It's happening in the United States and it's happening in Europe. So how do we remove more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Well, trees grow. I love the way that comes up like that. That's the way trees grow. They go from the bottom up. And you see a large tree on the left and you see a skinny tree on the right. Which tree has the most carbon in it? Half of the weight of wood is carbon. All right, the big one, obviously. Which tree absorbs more carbon dioxide every year? The big one. The foresters will tell you, we've got to get rid of those big trees. They're about to keel over and emit carbon dioxide. The one you see there is about 160 years old. It's in where I live, Massachusetts. It's the tallest tree in the whole northeastern United States. It's something in the neighborhood of 53 meters high. It's pretty good size. That's only half the height of the redwoods in California, by the way. But it's a big tree. These trees are remnants of what was once an entire forest like that. We just have remnants, but we have them. And so there's studies now showing that we have been managing our forests in such a way that if we manage them differently, they could absorb twice as much carbon dioxide as they already do now. Remember, forests and wetlands and the oceans are currently removing more than half of what we put in every year. That's amazing. That's really nice to have friends like that. We would really be in literally beyond hot water because the seas would have risen and the temperatures would be much warmer if it weren't for nature taking this carbon dioxide out.
But wait, I have a question because according to our president in the United States, President Trump allowing all these trees to grow so big and tall is causing forest fires and burning down the state of California.
Yes. Actually, it's the cutting down of trees that causes forest fires. You find that there is very, very few forest fires in old forests with big trees. How many of you have ever made a campfire or lit a fire in a fireplace? Have you ever put a match to a big log? It doesn't burn. What do? You get little sticks. Little sticks burn. The fires in California are almost all in areas that have been cut over by loggers and have smaller trees coming back. And if you look at the photos of Paradise, California, which was decimated by fire, there are still tall green trees standing in the ashes and ruins of the buildings. So it's not the big trees that are causing the problem. So what should we do? Well, if we were to allow more trees to get to be big trees and older trees, we would not only reduce forest fires, we would store much more carbon. And the process for that, proforestation management, allows trees to reach their biological potential for carbon storage.
I haven't heard that word before. Where did that word proforestation come from?
Guilty. When we realized what the great potential for nature was to let existing forests grow, we realized there was a word for planting trees where none grew, afforestation, a word for planting trees where forests had been cut down, reforestation. We talked about restoration to solve deforestation, but there was no word to describe this in less than four paragraphs. And so, to be honest with you, I went to Google and I Googled prefixes, and I got meta and all these words and everything, and I hit on pro. And so I talked to my co-authors, and we did a very scientific study by sharing with about a dozen of our friends and said, what do you think of this? And they said, it sounds good. Well, this paper has now been viewed over 16,000 times since it was published in June. It's really a concept that people recognize, and they are delighted to have a word for it. And here's something from a colleague of mine who is actually at a school of forestry. She's a forest ecologist, Beverly Law, one of the best of the best of the business. She says, remember, carbon in forests and soils is carbon, not in the atmosphere, right? And so let me just give you a quick little instruction here on how this works. So this is looking at how many tons of carbon there are in an acre of white pines in a temperate forest. I'm deliberately doing temperate forest because we are in Europe, which is a temperate forest zone, and I live in the United States. We keep pointing to tropical forests. They're hugely important because they have a lot of carbon stored, but they're actually not growing that fast. The old forests are growing relatively slowly, and a lot of deforestation is going on. Forests in the temperate zones have been kept young so long, they have the potential to grow a lot in the coming years. So let's just take a look here. So this is just showing the amounts of carbon on an acre. I'm sorry, this was a U.S. study. So that's 4/10 of a hectare. How many tons are in 4/10 of a hectare? And in 50-year increments. These are actual forests, actual measurements. This is not a model. All right. So why is the term carbon neutral not a good term? Well, we talk about sustainable forestry, meaning we cut down a forest. So we have a forest that has 22 tons in it, right, and at 50 years. We cut it down, and then we are so responsible that we either replant a forest or we plant a replacement forest, and it grows back in 50 years. And what happens then is the red line shows we have exactly what we had 50 years before, 22 tons. What would happen if we had let that forest continue growing, and we go and we find a 100-year-old forest of white pines, and it would have had 47 tons? All right, well, let's repeat this another round. We cut it down after it's grown back to its 22 tons, and we let it grow back, and we're back at 22 tons at 150 years. What would have happened if we'd allowed the original 22 tons to keep growing? It would be 76 tons. Remember, carbon that's in trees in a forest is carbon that's not in the atmosphere. Now, there are people who will tell you we can replace coal with wood, and Europe is doing this. More than half of all the renewable energy in Europe is burning something, burning wood, burning liquid fuels that come from plants. This is subsidized. It's not economically viable. It is leading to the deforestation of vast areas of the United States.
Hey, but it makes me money now.
Yes, right. That's right. It's in the United States and Canada. It's being shipped over here to Europe. The British are paying something like $800 million a year for a single power plant to replace coal with wood. Burning wood puts out more carbon dioxide per unit of electricity produced than coal does. That's not good. And we have foregone this possibility of really getting more removal rates. So
is it the size of the tree or the age of the tree? And if so, what about fast growth trees?
Right. It's the size of the tree that has how much carbon is stored. The type of tree determines how rapidly it gets there. So different trees do grow more rapidly, but we could get smart on this and say, well, only plant the fastest growing trees. No, it turns out that a forest of mixed species sequesters carbon more rapidly than a monoculture, which is what a lot of tree plantations are. It's just one tree for one purpose, and it turns out that all of the biodiversity of bacteria in the soils, of fungi in the soils, of pollinator birds, pollinator insects, pollinator bats, all make that forest grow much faster. So the takeaway message is reduce emissions of heat-trapping gases immediately, as anything you can do, any change in behavior. Protect more of our existing forests and let them grow. We've got to set aside some of our forests and say, let them grow. And if we do that, here's a forest, a picture of a forest in the Northeast U.S., and you see those little trees? Those are about to become big trees over the next 50 years, but they will be adding a lot starting tomorrow morning. Thank you.
Just an add-on to what he said, according to today's release, quote, red lights flashing, Australia smashes heat record just a day after previous record hit. I think this is the single loudest alarm bell I've ever heard on global heating. Calls for immediate and ambitious action to tackle the climate emergency piled up Thursday in response to preliminary analysis from Australia's Bureau of Meteorology that Wednesday smashed the nation's temperature record by a full 1 degree Celsius just one day after the previous all-time record. And the first record was set Tuesday, and now today it's jumped up higher. By the way, this is three straight days, the hottest days in the history of recorded records in Australia. The country is running out of water, and the country is on fire. The biggest fires in the world right now are in Australia, and just tens of thousands of kangaroos and, of course, the small little animals that can't run and climb in trees are burned to death in the trees. Most of the population of at least four different species are wiped out. Cattle, I saw a terrible picture of a little gorge where all the horses and cattle ran to protect themselves, and they were all dead. And this was published in the Sydney Monday Herald. Quote, the national temperature record could be broken for the third day in a row when it's analyzed by today. And by the way, New South Wales, which is Australia's most populous state and home to Sydney, the country's largest city, has been battling high temperatures and devastating bushfires for the past few months. This is the new norm. You're talking about a big country that if all of Australia put over the United States, excluding Alaska and Hawaii, it's about the same size, more or less, but a small, much smaller population, and it's just being destroyed. I said 4 years ago Australia was one of the countries that would not be sustainable, and now we're seeing it. And yet nothing has been done, nothing, to address these issues, there or any other country for that matter. We're going to address all this in the new film, and I'm going to watch that film in its rough cut form today for final input to my editors and color correction people and surround sound experts all in New York, and I'll premiere it when I come back to New York City. It will show you the whole history of what's going on and what we need to do. And please read the article Richard Gale and I wrote a week ago on the environment. Again, it's up on PRN.fm, and share these articles with people. Have a nice day, everyone.
When this old world starts getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face, I climb with